It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, yeah, yeah! Thunderstruck! Dang it! I mean, I go through the weekend, and I try and clear my mind. You know, I have friends that we had Gary Franchi from Restore the Republic here last week, and he was very pleasant to be around, and I think he kind of, dang, man, you know, they got it going on there, because we had a lot of research that was done on the movie that one of the documentaries that he's doing is called Enemy of the State, and it has a lot of things, you know, like the FEMA camp stuff and the mandatory inoculations that they wanted to do with the H1N1 and a lot of other things that are going on here, the immigration issue and different stuff. And he's like, wow, you know, there's a lot of footage I get in Arizona. Plus, it's pretty here. You know, and he went around the state, went up on the mountains. He goes to look at a homeland security facility near Florence where one of the large federal prisons are there, and they're going on about FEMA camps. You don't see a FEMA camp, and they got listed as a FEMA camp, you know, on conspiratorial websites and such. So he wanted to go out there and take a look. Well, Jet Lacy, one of the activists here, and he has a Friday morning, he has a show, The Revolution Continues, and he had actually gone there last year and taking pictures and so on. So, you know, it's kind of the traditional barbed wire facing inside, you know, that kind of thing. And it's Homeland Security facility. And he gets up on a ridge, a mountain, and he's taking video of it. And I'm sure it's going to be great footage for his movie. And then all of a sudden they start seeing explosions. Boom! Boom! There was a training exercise out there, and it had these signs, you know, checkpoint ahead, and it's in English and Arabic. And, you know, so, you know, that's good footage. He's going to whatever their training they were doing. But I'm wow. It's just one thing after another. And, you know, you want to just relax and you go to the lake. And we go up there as a family, and you meet people, and you see things, and talk to them about different. You know, it's just overwhelming. It's overwhelming. It's going to be a lot worse than people realize, because if you know what to look for and what the fundamentals are, you can see that there's this wave of issues that affect people at a fundamental. It's not like an opinion thing, and I'd prefer and all that. It's like I'm going to be able to eat. I have a place to live. I can afford to fix my car. I mean, and if your air conditioning goes out, you don't have electricity here in Arizona. They call air conditioning here life support. You know, I'm telling you, Arizona didn't start exploding until they started having air conditioning. It was desert. I mean, they had a winter visitor thing, but I'm feeling there's some other stuff about housing I wanted to talk to you about. There's so much stuff. I just want you to know, normally I'm upbeat. You know, I'm just, yeah, whatever. Humanity marches on. We'll go and, you know, cast off the, you know, but the forces lined against us is so enormous that we have to, there is no organization that's going to compete with. There's no collective that's going to compete against them. There's no rising up and, you know, have the, you know, right stripe on your arm or the armband or the right color beret or something like that that's going to beat. It's much more fundamental than that. I mean, it's grasping on and holding on, wrapping your arms and legs around your own humanity. But do you even know what that is? I don't know. Let's see what Stephen knows. I got you there, Stephen. Hello. Board, you got him? I don't know, maybe they stepped out. Put Steve in up. You guys there? Hello? Okay, so they are writing. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and see if Steve, I'll give out the number today. We'll do some conversation. 866-986-6397. 866-986-6397. We'll go ahead and take some calls today because I just want to share some stuff with you. You know, usually I have a lot of stuff planned and we do it. And it's just really, really starting to overwhelm me. And what's the solution? And I don't know anything else other than exactly what I'm doing right now. You know, just sharing information, give a perspective. Because it's one thing when I was talking to Dar, you have to keep in mind, he was heavily promoted on all the left blogs. I mean, he was on Common Dreams and Daily Cause and Huffington Post. And, you know, when we were talking to him, I guarantee you he wasn't getting the same questions we were. So we became acquainted with each other, you know, friendly. And double digits at least, he's been on my show and Charles's show. And we really got to know him what he did is he embedded himself with families. He's from, I guess he said Houston, but he lived in Alaska for a long time, and he has dark hair, and if he grows his beard out puts a turban on, I mean, you know, he can pass as whatever. So, but he doesn't speak any Arabic, so he had to have a translator, and he had to be very careful because he was outside of the green zone, where the real news was. And he's talking to people and getting reports of what was really going on during that, and he could see how much the government lies, and I don't know what he was expecting back here to happen. And, it's the same thing. There is, when we come back in the next segment, I'm going to play for you. There's this promotional film that I found that was on Gulf oil spill bioremediation solution restores environment in just 6 weeks, blah, blah, blah. And the part about this, it'll only be about 5 minutes, but it was a promotional film that was done back in the 80s or maybe even in the 90s. And it was all on them testing and using this stuff before. And the byproduct was, I don't know, bacteria farts or something. I mean, you know, it would actually clean the oil. I mean, it was gone. And it was just natural. I mean, nature's going to take care of it anyway. Sooner or later, the oil goes away one way or another. How do you think that happens? Well, it's, you know, it gets exposed to whatever, you know, the environment, you know, being microbes, they'll eventually, you know, eat it away. It may take years or decades even. But when you start adding in all these other man-made chemical stuff, you're just begging for trouble. And it was all about what Dar was talking about. You get charged for, you know, surface area, dead fish, how many dolphins. I mean, you know, it's sick. Sick. We're depending on somebody else to do stuff for us too much. And it's getting to the point to where I tell you what my concern is. Normally, when I start to feel bad and I just, you know, whatever, you know, it's just you do more to get ready. You go shopping with friends. We'll go out and we'll get some stuff. You know, we'll go. We went to the movie and saw Inception again. He hadn't seen Inception. My good friend Bob Anderson. He's the Palo Verde guy that, you know, is in charge of the core changing out and so on when they do the refueling of the nuclear power plant out there. And he's a Uber guy. And he moved out past the plant out there on his own land. He has like 8 acres. And he did this probably 6, 7, 8 years ago. And he just, you know, got tired of the drive. It was starting to get busy. And it's a ways out there. It's probably a good 50, 60 miles out. And so he just said, well, I'll just move out there and get some cheap land. I'll build my own. And, well, of course, they wanted to charge, you know, $20,000, $30,000 to bring power out. And all that. He goes, you know what? For that, I can have my own. So he did. It has a battery pack, solar, wind generator, propane and diesel generators, well, septic, satellite, internet, cell telephone. He is totally off grid. Not a single line goes to his property. What kind of life does he have? High standard. He promised his wife that she wouldn't suffer. They have 2 young children. And they have 3 other children from a combined marriage. And then all of a sudden they have 2 little children doing fantastic. Well, they didn't suffer any kind of a lifestyle change at all. Can this be done anywhere around the planet? Yeah, one way or another. You know, this is, I mean, he's not totally off grid. During the summer, he has run the generator for, you know, I don't know, half the day for 3 months, 2 months out of the year. But other than that, he's good. And then what does he do? He gets these, I can't remember what they call, Argentine jojoba beans or something like that. He wanted to have just to see if he could grow his own biodiesel. And then he's looking into the algae biodiesel just so he could. Just so I can, you know what? You know, someday, and it's going to be suck to be you. And so we go out and we just spend time getting caught up yesterday. And it's just, we share with each other all the stuff that we've learned. And we're like, wow, I have grandkids. He has small kids. What are we to do? What are we to prepare for? We'll talk about it a little bit when we come back. And I'll play this by.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Most Texans remember these news photographs of the megaborg burning out of control in the Gulf of Mexico, releasing 4.6 million gallons of toxic crude oil. What you may not remember is a smaller story, the first open sea application of oil-eating microbes to help clean up the mess. Microbes, with a natural appetite for oil, live everywhere in the environment. They're nature's recycling units, capable of eating toxic oil and digesting it into byproducts, which are then safely consumed by marine life. Researchers have collected microbes from all over the world and mixed them together in combinations which will address nearly all toxins in oil pollution. They're grown in a catalytic solution to reproduce quickly until trillions are available to be packaged, stored in a powder form, and applied when needed to help clean up sensitive environmental areas. Microbe research attracted the attention of Texas Land Commissioner Gary Morrow, who for years had been the state's strongest proponent for clean beaches. The Texas General Land Office funded a test of the microbes in the fall of 1989 to learn more about them.
The test is designed to show the efficiency of using a biological process to remove oil from the environment, especially oil that's on the surface of the sea.
First, oil was released into a controlled pond. Next, microbes in a powder form were scattered over the top of the oil with an ordinary flour sifter. Within minutes, the oil slick began to disappear as the microbes did their work, releasing byproducts which are safely edible by marine life. Shrimp, which had been placed in the control tank, began to rise to the top and nibble on the microbe byproduct as it slowly sank to the bottom. Once the oil had been consumed, the microbes began to die off due to lack of a food supply. The microbe level in the ponds quickly returned to normal. Water samples were taken for analysis by Lower Colorado River Authority experts and later reported to be non-toxic and effective. Then the megaborg, loaded with 38 million gallons of crude oil, caught fire. For several days, it burned out of control in the open Gulf of Mexico. Commissioner Morrow and the Land Office pushed for and finally won the right to use this potential disaster for the first open-sea testing of the oil-eating microbes. The powdered microbes are mixed with water, then applied using standard firefighting equipment. Cost is about one-tenth of the price of current spill response techniques. Later in Houston, Commissioner Morrow and Texas Water Commissioner Buck Wynn announced the results.
If you can believe your eyes, we had a great success. And if you can believe the scientific results of our small-scale application test, we're on the verge of a major breakthrough. We have absolutely no evidence that there are any harmful side effects from these microbes. It's time for us involved in oil spill response to put bioremediation at the center of our oil spill contingency plans.
And when you look at the tools we presently have to work with, booms, skimmers, dispersants, and absorbents, bioremediation stands out above all of them. Because these naturally occurring microorganisms appear to degrade significant quantities of oil in a startlingly short period of time, and because we have yet to identify any harmful side effects from the products used, I am persuaded that this technology can be developed and used as a valuable weapon in our arsenal to deal with future oil spills.
Little did the two officials know that in about 2 weeks, they'd have to make good on their promise. A barge filled with heavy crude was struck by a ship and began leaking its contents into Galveston Bay. This time, it was not the open beaches that were threatened, but the sensitive marshes and breeding grounds of many aquatic birds and other marine life. As oil flowed into the marshy areas, cleanup was begun. But workers quickly found standard skimmers, booms, and sorbent materials hardly worked at all. And just walking through the wetlands can harm the grasses almost as much as the toxic oil. Dispersants could not be used because they also were toxic to both wildlife and plants. Application of microbes was again authorized, this time in marked zones, so specific conclusions could be drawn about their effectiveness. Microbes were sprayed with hoses from boats offshore, minimizing trampling of the marsh grasses. Just 6 weeks later, the results were evident. In areas where bioremediation was used, grasses flourished and the mud banks had returned to normal. Small living creatures returned to the area. All signs of shoreline discoloration had disappeared. In those areas left untreated, marsh grass was brown and dead, and wildlife absent or endangered. At a bioremediation symposium at Lamar University, Commissioner Morrow commented on the results.
I hope today's symposium puts all Texas movers and receivers of oil on notice that at least the General Land Office, which manages the 4 million acres of submerged lands, expects bioremediation to be part of any oil spill contingency plan they have.
Well. Spillfighters.com, where you can get some more information on that. So I remember seeing that when this first started, and I think we talked about it on the show. I anticipated that they would do this. It worked before. It's not a secret. You know, it's been approved and tested by, you know, Gulf states. And it's not being employed. Why? Just asking why on a lot of these questions is going to illuminate a lot of things for a lot of people. What's going to be their solution? More government! Let's do a Blue Ribbon panel to have a committee to study the effects of this talking about having a meeting. I mean, you know, I get it. You know, this is, and then when they do finally do create something, guess who's going to populate the board? Guess who's going to write the rules? You know, there are too many rules. There's too many limits. There's too many agencies. There's too many levels. It was done intentionally. It's feel good, blah, blah, blah. And then what do? Anybody that would oppose anything or understand what's going on, they just buy you off. Need a grant for that university research thing you got going there? Yeah, baby, we got some goodie for you right here. Just say this or don't say that. Okay, that's how it's going to be. Well, it's not just this Gulf thing. I mean, it's everything. It's the Persian Gulf. It's the Gulf of Mexico. It's the Gulf between, you know, people and the promise that the government made that they were going to, you know, protect them. Allow them to be whatever they wanted to be. Be all you can be. But you have to join the army. Okay. Well, it brings up another thing that we're working on. I'll give you kind of a little heads up on it. It involves how the real estate and all the housing is going to be disposed of. We came across something that we've been researching. A lot of you that have been with the show for quite some time, for many months. We started, it was end of last year, beginning of the year. We wanted to understand what a mortgage-backed security was. I wanted to understand who's going to get all the property. I wanted to understand the flow, because it always comes down to, you know, what's yours is now mine. They create buckets. They fill the bucket. They take the bucket. That's all government's done. You know, it's collective whatever. Your liberties, your treasure, your retirement, your pension, your whatever it is, they put it in the bucket. Then somebody's going to take it. You're not in control of the bucket. You can't take your stuff out of the bucket. It's in the bucket. And then all of a sudden, the bucket's empty. That's just the way it is. Anybody advocates for more buckets or put more stuff in it, they're just, it's just delayed robbery. Okay, they're going to get it sooner or later. Well, one of the things that we wanted to track was the housing. Where's the collective bucket for all these houses that are vacant? We went through this before here in Arizona. It was called the SNL loan scandal, the savings and loan scandal. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars there. Well, now we're looking at trillions and trillions of dollars. We need to follow. I want to start following through this one group of houses, and we're going to walk it through, and we're going to learn. I'm not going to tell you where exactly it is, because we don't want to give them a heads up yet.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Theme here? I just like the drums. But, you know, I want to make sure I'm trying to be inspirational. You know, I've been doing this a long time. And if you don't, you know, it's always about the positive, because positive always trumps negative emotions. And if you're feeling bad, positive emotions always, you know, trump the negative. And I always train myself, and I taught my kids this, and my friends, and my wife, and understands that I sleep really well because I choose not to worry. If I'm worried about something, if something's bothering me, it means that I need to do something. It means I should be more aware of something. There's something that needs to be done. No matter how short you are of money, no matter how big the problem, no matter how, you know, someone that you love is in pain or injured, or no matter what it is, if you're feeling bad, it's a sign that you need to do something. That's how I've always seen it. It's a trigger. You know, I need to do something. I need to do more research. I need to, you know, get in an expert. I need to be more involved about the illness. I need to know more about the event. I need to know more how to communicate a solution. I need, once I do everything that I can up to that time until, you know, my brain just starts to shut down from being tired, you know, once I make that decision to do everything that I can, I can feel good about my effort, then I don't worry anymore. I did what I could. That is where a lot of people get into a cycle of pain and worry. A lot of times, just trying to understand a problem more is, a lot of times the solution presents itself. A lot of times there isn't a solution. A lot of times it's just, you know, well, nothing I can do about that, and, you know, peace be upon thee, and, you know, I'll send you a get well card, or I'll write a letter to the editor, or I'll just ignore it, or I'll, you know, when the circumstances are better, I'll take care of it next time. Because I've made the effort, I have a lot of creative things that I can do, a lot of contacts, a lot of people, because it's just a decision that I made. I just convinced myself that, you know, I need to do something other than worry. It's not productive. I don't like it. So I tell you what's been one of the things I've been worrying about. During the savings and loan thing, I'm a young man, and it had a big impact on, you know, my new family and so on. My wife, we had four little kids, and the economy here and such. And it's kind of like Jack Gregson, that we have our economist columnist for Freedom's Phoenix. He does a lot of research and such, and he'll put a lot of things up on Freedom's Phoenix. But, you know, I remember when he was in Southern California, and, you know, his whole family got enormously affected, even from the Great Depression. You know, his family used to own a lot of the land that's now San Francisco. And it was just watching a trending of how he saw what happened in California in the 90s and how that devastated his family members with the real estate and such there, and saw it coming again and saw it coming here in Arizona. He didn't get caught this time. He goes, yeah, I've been through this before. Time to sell at the Peak in Ahwatukee, which is a very nice community and just south of Phoenix here. I think it's still in the Phoenix limits. They just call it Ahwatukee. And he said, nope, we're out. You know, bought some precious metals, just kind of sit back, ride this one out. You know, he's doing fine. But, you know, I've done the same kind of thing on, you know, a lot of things. You just kind of sit back. You know, it wouldn't be prudent at this juncture to buy a house. But it's low. It's at the lowest it's ever been. It's going to, you know, go up from here. The sky's the limit. No. So I've been keeping track. There, I'll just tell you a story and give you an example, and you understand what's going on. In Northwest Valley here in Arizona, I'm sure you'll have the same kind of development in any large metropolitan area where you live. There's always some small community that was on the outskirts of the metropolis, and then all of a sudden it was a nice little place to live and kind of just, you know, small town, leave me alone, but gosh darn it, a highway got built out to you. And you can tell the developers, they're all part of the government, just like the oil industry is, you know, the federal government and agencies and all that kind of stuff, who really runs Arizona, or at least it did, were the developers, real estate. Because there's so much desert here that a lot of it is not in private hands. Only about 13 to 16% of Arizona's in private hands. The rest of it is, you know, Indian reservation, or it's forest land, or it's missile ranges, or it's military bases or something, you know. So you really don't have that much land here. And the state land that there is, originally when we became a state, the Enabling Act, the land that the federal government kind of just said in the territory, said, it's y'all's now, go have fun. In our state constitution, there was a requirement that you have public education. Well, right off the bat, you want to control something, you fund it. You know, there was always this, we want to have, you know, a government-funded education system. We were the last continental United States state. Okay, it's 1912. We're having our centennial coming up here in a little bit. So what they did is they made it part of the government to fund education. Not all states were like that. Of course, they all do it, but, you know, it wasn't a constitutional requirement. So how they were going to fund that, okay, fine, then how do you fund it? Well, with the sale of all this land that we give. You got enough land last year for freaking ever. You sell off the land and use the proceeds for education. Or you do what's called leasing of the land, land leases. So you have ranchers, they don't, you know, necessarily have to buy the land. They don't really want to own the land. They just want to have land to run their cattle on. You know, here's a couple of bucks and I'll run my cattle. Well, then you get environmentalists, oh, you know, they're doing damage and got cow patties everywhere or something, you know, whatever. But the thing was is that you'd have land use. And I remember I used to fly ultralights, you know, little airplanes and so on. And there was one of the places they wanted to have a I was training for something, it's a long story, but I remember the group, they were like, look, we need to have a little strip right about out here in northern Phoenix, north of the valley, because it's growing so much, or everything's in our way, it's taking over our landing strips, and we just need a place, we'll do a land lease on this little property right here, just so we'll just level out a little place out in the desert, and we're good. It's all done. Fold up the wings, put it, you know, trailer it back home, go do whatever, we just need a place that just has safety. And I go, cool, I'll check into it. Well, you can do that. Well, what I found out is that there are large companies, individuals, developers, and so on, that do land leases on a bunch of property because they know what's going to happen. They know sooner or later they're going to trade that land for something and give it to a developer. They change legislation. They'll say, okay, we're doing a land swap. We're going to get this little canyon to save the little cactus, wren, bird, fish, rodent, whatever the heck it is over here. And we'll take that off of the private rules and make that part of the state management kind of thing so we can free up this land because there was some kind of legal requirement they do something like that. Then they're just, okay, well, we're just selling it and do this fund to education, of course, which is so over, the budget has gotten so much. You sold all the land and it wouldn't make a dent. So what they, because they use property taxes now. So what they did is they have all this land around the valley that imagine, you know, a small disc, you know, like a quarter, okay, then all of a sudden, boom, it becomes a frisbee. Well, the city of Phoenix and its small communities around were, you know, it was like a quarter, and then you had a little dime up next to it, and a nickel and a penny and another couple of dimes around. Then all of a sudden, it just became a one big silver dollar, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's a frisbee, all right? Then it becomes a, you know, a, I don't know, a skating rink. And it just keeps growing out. Well, that's desert. That's state land. You know, how do they get it? Some way they are able to, Del Webb builds another Anthem or Sun City or Sun City 14 or whatever the heck it is. They want to be able to get that land. Now, they will not expand that land to just individuals. Well, I want some. You know, put it up. How many are you doing? How many acres? You're putting up 1,000 acres for auction to whatever section to whatever. Okay, well, I want one of them. I'll bid on it. I'll bid up with anybody. No, 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 no. It's got to all go at one time. Only those with $200 million get to bid. Oh, but then each acre is what? I don't know, $5,000 an acre or something in prime real estate? Because they won't let you do it. It has to go in one big lot. Why? For the developers. So they take all this cheap land and they build all these homes. Well, when they build these homes, they just mass, because they have almost nothing for the land, and they just build these homes, and then they have the cities providing the infrastructure. Sidewalks, roads, street lights, water, gas. You start to see the point. Who really runs this state? It's not the oil companies, it's the developers. But the result of that was a lot of homes. What are they going to do with them? They're vacant. We'll talk about it when we come back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, where we're going through the same thing I'm sure you are in your area, and I'm going to follow it through so that we can understand where this is going. I already know. I'm just, you know, trying to give a roadmap. So here in Arizona, we have enormous amount of land. If you fly a jet airplane coming out of LaGuardia, or you're coming out of Boston or Chicago or something, you look around, I mean, every square foot is gridded off or something. You know, it's farmland, or it's cities or what. And then you start getting into some of the forest and so on, you might, you know, see a little bit different. But when you go to the Southwest, I mean, dang, you know, it's just open land. But a lot of that's not available. You know, and what they do is they'll open up a little bit, you know, a little bit more, a little bit. But to who? You know, to whom? It goes to the developers, the people that, just like the oil companies control the government, just like the military-industrial complex control the government, just like the banks control the government, just like, you know, I mean, they're all part of the same thing. It's who controls the guys that wearing the shiny badges in the legislature. Well, they make sure that they do not want land to just be released to the people, put it in private hands. You know, you guys duke it out and exchange and do whatever. We'll record it at the county recorder's office, and we'll just keep record of who owns what, and have a nice day, and we don't care. No. They got to control prices. And they control the land. So it goes to the developers. They develop it, and they say, hey, we don't want to have it, you know, like next to us, a bunch of other land available, and people just go buy it. Now, of course, what would they do? The price of land would go way down. Price of homes would go way down.
They'd have more space between the homes. They wouldn't be concentrated so much. They may have different kind of communities. They'd based on their own, what, you know, they'd have a homeowners association. They wouldn't have one. If they did, what would it take? Would it have to be a cookie cutter, one that's created by our city governments and so on, which they are? So you're going, okay. So they're not releasing this land because it affects the pricing of what's available for them. Well, the developers during the boom here, all caution went to the winds, and they just said, gimme, 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 gimme. So a lot of land went into developer hands, and they developed it. Well, some of the land, they have in unincorporated areas that was private and kind of released in between these, and it's just sitting out there in the Northwest Valley where Sun City is, your retirement community. North of that is a small town called Surprise, and you got Peoria and Avondale, and it goes on up to Morristown and Wickenburg, and these small towns where Wickenburg used to be the center of the universe. It was bigger than Phoenix because that's where the gold and silver mines were and so on. Then they came down to Phoenix, and they took in the off-season, I guess, or whatever it was, they took the mules down here and carved out the canals that the Native Americans had here. So you had indigenous people. They knew the flow of the rivers and so on, and they created a canal system. They started doing agriculture. During, that's why I call it Roosevelt Dam here, or Roosevelt Lake, you have the one of the big projects of FDR was the building of this enormous dam here that created the Roosevelt Lake that is a reservoir for a lot of the water for the valley. So that made a big difference. So now you're looking at, you know, a controlled supply. When the demand is there by those in charge that they can benefit from it, that they think they can get somebody to get in at the price that makes them the most money, then they will leak out a little bit more land for them to build. Well, of course, you create a big, giant, you know, circumference that you don't have the distance that it takes to walk around a quarter. Now you got to walk around a Frisbee, okay? So you have all of these different interests. It just keeps growing, growing. We need more and more and more and more and more. And they start, they build and they build and they build. And all of a sudden, you have a whole bunch of homes, even in ones that aren't in subdivisions. There are homes that are nice, remote desert areas that are million-dollar homes that have never been lived in, even more. A lot of them are in about, you know, they went the traditional three-car garage. You have a double garage and another single. You know, you got to have your boat. Arizona has the highest per capita boat ownership in the nation. Arizona, because it's hot. More than Florida, you know, more than California, more than anywhere else. If you live in Arizona, you're more likely to own a boat than anywhere else in the nation. Surprising. Not when you know how hot it is here. So what they do is they go, all right, well, we're going to have a three-car garage. All right, well, we're going to have at least four bedrooms. We're going to have an Arizona great room. We're going to have a patio. We're going to have a deck on top. We're going to have to. And we want at least an acre of land. I mean, if you're going to live out there, you want to be, it's desert. I need some acre of land. Well, then they usually, it's a gravel road. You know, you're going to come off of some highway that goes on to some byway that goes on to your gravel road that goes to you and your neighbors and so on. And then they'll go, I'm tired of the dust and I need more. And we get annexed or want to be annexed, or they create their own town and then they start taxing everybody and we got to have, but what about the roads? Okay. You just, instead of before what it was, they just went out and they graded it, or somebody had their own, you know, blade and they, you know, whatever. It's just, this is how government starts, you know, because they want everybody else to pay for whatever it is that they want. This is how it goes. Well, before we get there, now you have a home, a nice home sitting on an acre or more land, never been lived in. You have 2, 3, 5, 10. We started tracking this. We're looking for some place that we were interested in. A friend of mine lived up there, and his father was in real estate before he got older and he started getting infirm. So he doesn't deal in real estate anymore, but of course he knows what's what. So he started tracking some homes for us over the last few years. There was a development company or small builder, contractor, did quality work. You know, you go and you look them up on Google and you start doing some research and all this stuff, where they came from, who they were, what they were doing. They would build in construction maybe 2-3 homes at a time. And so they weren't a big, giant developer. So their niche was they'd find, you know, these properties out there. They'd buy up a bunch of property, get, you know, 10, 20 acres, and they would build, you know, 10 homes, you know, maybe 15 or so. And they would just start build one, two at a time. They'd sell it and go to another one, go on the boom's going. Man, it's going good. All of a sudden, you know, it's 2005, 6, 7, 8. And things are starting to crumble. They got money into it. They can't get out from under it. They're losing $100,000, $200,000 a home. It cost them, you know, $200,000 to build a $500,000 home that now they can't sell for $120,000. So they go bankrupt. They get refinancing. They get this bank that does this bank and so on, whatever, and this bank sells to this bank. And then, you know, they go bankrupt. They got all these people wanting money, you know, from them for the air conditioner that they put in or doing whatever construction, and they can't, and they go bankrupt. So they're done. They're gone. What happened to the property? It goes back to the bank. The bank then sells it to another bank. That then, you know, part of the Goldman Sachs thing, we got the TARP, we got the bailout. Well, there are programs to where these banks, what they do, I'll try and find, you know, remind me, the FDIC, no, it was called Indy Mac scam. And what it was, FDIC, Indy Mac, we'll pull it up and see if you can get something out of it from the audio, and I'll try and describe what it is, and next hour we'll go ahead and play it for you. But what they did is, let's say you had a mortgage for $100,000, $1 million. You got $1 million mortgage. Well, the mortgage is $1 million, but, you know, the bank, you know, takes it, and then they sell it to someone else for, I don't know, they're stuck with it. So the government says, you know what, we'll go ahead and guarantee up to, I don't know, 80% of whatever the original loan was. Well, if the people put a couple $100,000 down on it, they're at, you know, $800,000 already. So they're going to get their $800,000 back from the government. You know, so what do? They'll do a short sale. And they'll sell it for, you know, whatever, you know, $500,000. Well, the government's going to give them, you know, the $800,000 anyway. So they buy it from a bank for $500,000, sell it for, you know, whatever. They get $800,000 and keep the profit and the difference because the government guaranteed a certain percentage of what the original loan was. Not what they bought it for, not what it was before. And so who you think gets in line for this, Goldman Sachs? These guys are all, and we'll play it and it'll probably explain it a little bit better, but it's complicated. But the thing is that all this government intervention, it just distorts the market. But what they're doing is they're starting, and this is what I wanted to track. All of these homes are going to be liquidated somehow. But in the process of them doing all this, they separated the obligation with the ability to foreclose. They wanted to create these mortgage-backed securities that gave people access to the revenue stream, but it didn't really give them any kind of ownership. So that went to these pension funds that, you know, invested all this money in these mortgage-backed securities, so they got the revenue stream from people paying their payments. But what happens when they stop? The mortgage-backed security is just, you know, for the revenue stream. It's not any ownership or anything in the property, so they can't foreclose. That's what's clogging up all the system. So what are they going to do? They are positioning themselves right now. Bring the music down a little bit. They're positioning themselves right now in a situation to where what they're going to be doing is they're going to retroactively massage and move all these properties into some such a way and then say, anybody that owns a property based on this, there's a law that passed that now it's yours and you can foreclose and take and do and sell and whatever. And oh, guess who it is? It's Goldman Sachs. They're doing this. I'm going to track it for us. I need to understand this. We're following this through. And I'm going to share it with you. And it's going to take a while. We'll talk about it every month or so and see where we're at on this. Because I know it's coming. It happened before. It was called the savings and loan. Your money into their pockets.